From the studios of KPCW, welcome to This Green Earth. It's a weekly talk show about the environment and our impacts upon it. I'm Claire Wiley, and on today's show, we have award-winning birder and acclaimed writer Pete Dunn. Pete will join us to chat about his latest book. It's called The Courage of Birds. From our own backyard to the rim of the Arctic ice, countless birds have adapted to meet the challenges of the winter season. Dunn will share with us his remarkable stories of our feathered friends. And then biologist and award-winning author David George Haskell is coming on the show to share more about his highly acclaimed book, Sounds Wild and Broken. Starting with the origins of animal song and traversing the whole arc of Earth history, Haskell illuminates and celebrates the emergence of the varied sounds of our world. From rainforests booming with insect sounds to swamps pulsing with frog calls, we learn about evolution's creative powers. Sounds Wild and Broken was also a finalist for the 2023 Pulitzer Prize and the Editor's Choice for the New York Times Book Review. All that is coming up on This Green Earth.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
And joining us for this part of the show is Pete Dunn. Pete is an author and founder of the World Series of Birding, a former director of natural history information for the New Jersey Audubon Society, and former director of the Cape May Bird Observatory. He's also the author of the new book, The Courage of Birds, and the often surprising ways they survive winter. Pete Dunn, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, every birder I know, including myself, Pete, has an origin story or so as far as, you know, how we got into birding. Maybe it was a single moment or maybe a collection of moments that got us attracted and involved in the birding world. Do you have an origin story like that?
Well, I do indeed. I was 7 years old, suburban kid growing up in northern New Jersey, and my neighbor, Donna McDowell, was given binoculars and a field guide for her birthday. So she came running over to our house, you know, clutching these things in her arms, and said, look what I got for my birthday. And then she said, let's go on a bird hike. Well, I had no idea what it meant, and she didn't either, but we knew that the early bird caught the worm. So the next morning at 0:30, she climbed out her bedroom window, and she and I went back into the woods, and I found out that it was a great way to get away from adults, and so I continued to do it.
Wait a minute. Did you say this was when you were seven?
Seven, yes.
Okay. That's fantastic. Well, you're from New Jersey. I'm from South Jersey, down in Cumberland County. So, you know, kind of near.
Well, that's where I live now. So where?
I grew up in Vineland. So my origin story is something along those lines. When I was a kid, the first time I saw a flock of evening grosbeaks literally pillage our backyard feeder of all the sunflower seeds, that's what hooked me. Because they're such a beautiful bird, so regal.
Well, they're a designer bird.
What's that?
They're a designer bird.
Designer bird, perfect. So that's how I kind of got hooked on it. So you've been birding ever since for decades and decades, written a number of books about birds, but talk to us about your latest book, The Courage of Birds, and the surprising ways they survive winter.
Well, it was almost an accidental beginning. I saw, as many people did, the movie March of the Penguins, which was a phenomenal documentary about the extraordinary breeding strategy of the emperor penguin, which go out onto the Antarctic ice sheet to raise their young in the middle of the Antarctic winter. Of course, the reason they do that is to get away from predators. The leopard seals are under the ice. The skuas are all gone. So their breeding success goes up, even though they have to face incredible hardships to accomplish this feat. But I thought to myself, you know, the birds in North America have got amazing strategies too. They deserve a shake. So I think I'll do a book.
Yeah.
So Surviving the winter sounds like as I could think about, there's maybe three ways of doing it. You either stay and you kind of adapt to it and tough it out. You migrate south or in some other direction away from the winter. Or maybe there are birds that maybe kind of hibernate. I don't know. Give us a sense of how birds in general manage the winter.
Well, you put your finger on the three main strategies, but there is actually one bird that does hibernate, the poorwill. And its Native American name that I forget right now, although it was in my book, is translates to the sleeping one. But most of our birds actually have a hybrid strategy. Only a handful, maybe close to 50 birds remain in the far north in winter, but about 80% of the birds migrate at least a short distance. So all they need to do is move someplace where they've got more resources and maybe less snow on the ground. So most of our North American breeders actually remain in North America. They just migrate short distances.
So let's kind of go into some of the obvious or notable features of birds that might be used to survive these winters. And feathers, obviously, is the first thing that comes to mind. What are some of the ways in which feathers are used as a defense against a harsh winter?
Well, probably many of the people listening to this own down jackets. So they know how warm down is. And eiderdown is actually the warmest natural substance known to our species. A pinch of it on the arm registers warmth, not weight. And then you have the outer covering of feathers, which provide waterproofing, camouflage, and during the breeding season, help birds stand out. And if you were to ask a structural engineer to design a covering that is waterproof, lightweight, flexible, can be easily replaced, be as light as a feather, they can hardly come up with a design better than a feather.
Absolutely. And so they utilize these to help obviously keep them warm, insulate them. But digging into a few more of these anti-cold strategies that are maybe similar to what humans do, maybe I saw you talk about sunning or cuddling or shivering as even a defense mechanisms against the cold.
Birds can utilize a lot of defenses. One of them, of course, is fluffing up that down. They have little muscles that allow them to raise the feathers so they fluff and trap more air close to the skin. And then a lot of birds also, as you just, I think, suggested, will, and as the emperor penguin does, huddle up. So share their body warmth.
And how does shivering play a role in a bird's defense?
In the same way it does with humans, it generates heat.
Yeah.
But birds can actually shiver on command, where normally we just have to wait till we get cold.
So they will utilize this purposefully.
Yes. That's a lot of chickadees when they wake up in the morning after a cold night. They've got to get get up to operating temperature, and so they'll shiver, metabolizing some of the fat that's laid down. Because they probably burned through all the food that they went to bed with in their crop. And then when they get up to operating temperature, they go out and they start foraging.
And foraging, that's interesting because I was also thinking that migration can be a function of the need to migrate, can be a function of weather and climate conditions, too cold, but can also be a function of food, or the lack of food over winter. So that's another migratory trigger, let's say.
I don't know whether it's a trigger per se, but it is the reason that birds migrate. They need to find resources for the winter. Upwards like osprey that depend upon open fish-bearing water have got to get out of Dodge because if you're living in Canada and everything's frozen, there's no fish to catch.
So I'm also interested in how that evolved over time. You know, the birds that migrate, you mentioned they may not have to migrate very far, maybe a couple hundred miles, but there are, of course, species that migrate thousands of miles. Is there any sense of how that evolved over time? Did the first species say, well, we'll just go a few hundred miles, and they figure out, you know what, we got to go farther, and we have to go farther and farther before we find our food source?
Well, it's a matter of trial and error. If you have a strategy that works, you get to pass that on to the next generation, and sometimes birds goof. Where I live in New Jersey, great blue herons try in winter. And most winters, they get away with it. But you get a bad winter where all the water freezes over, and they don't make it.
They don't make it.
So they goofed.
Yeah, so can you talk about that relationship to food and food scarcity, and maybe even that evolutionary relationship that birds have with seeds and the development of their movement as in conjunction with where the food is and the seeds are, and how they're also changing that ecosystem?
Well, seeds evolved millions of years ago, and then took birds a little while to figure out that this is a good food resource. And food and seeds change the game. I mean, a lot of birds that breed in the north are insectivorous in the summer, but having a protein source in the winter allowed them to stay north. So where many birds would have to migrate when wet temperatures drop to find insects, now some species evolved to feed on seeds. You know, the obvious ones are the winter finch. And when the seed crop fails, that's when they have their eruptions. They go farther south.
Yeah, talk about that. Talk about eruptions and define that and talk about that movement.
Some birds are highly dependent on, say, birch seeds. We'll say that, or acorns. Let me go to acorns. Acorns are used by jays, fed upon by jays. As a matter of fact, it's been speculated that most of the oaks in the eastern deciduous forest were planted by jays that didn't come back for the acorn that they planted earlier in the fall. Either they forgot it or they might have died. So jays, which are normally resident species, when the acorn crop fails, they've got to get out of Dodge. And they migrate during the day so that when they pass over forests, they can see places that have got lots of acorns. You know, and if they find a place that's got lots of mast, they go, okay, this is the place.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Pete Dunn. He's the author of the new book, Courage of Birds and the Often Surprising Ways They Survive Winter. Now, Pete, in a warming world, are birders, scientists, researchers seeing migratory patterns changing or shifting in some way?
I don't see the migratory patterns shifting so much as breeding areas. Some birds, generalists, are going to do fairly well, but some birds that are specialized to certain altitudes, I mean, for a while they can keep going up, 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 but as the strategy goes, that doesn't work forever. Pretty soon you run out of up.
Okay, and are you seeing birds migrate farther, say, north during the summer or so, that maybe you didn't see previously, to kind of to get out of the heat? I know I'm kind of switching things, but is there a reverse migration going on?
There's, in every generation, there are a certain number of birds that are going to take the path less followed. And if that strategy works, they pass it on. I mean, what I've noticed is, in migration, a lot of the warblers are dependent on flowering oaks. because the flowering oaks attract insects. Now, if the oaks are flowering before the birds get there, then they're going to have to go figure out how to find insects elsewhere. So that's going to pose a challenge to them.
Okay.
Let's kind of shift topics a bit. We have a few more minutes. What is the World Series of Birding, and when does it help?
It happens in May, generally the second week in May, which in New Jersey is the peak of the migration. And it is a competition among avid birders to see who can find the most species of birds in 24 hours, midnight to midnight.
Either as a single person, a birder, or a group?
There's different levels. You can do it as an individual, but the highly competitive teams are between 3 and 5 individuals. And many of them have got sponsors, corporate sponsors, who are in it for the publicity. And one of the reasons that I developed this was not so much as a fundraiser, but to draw attention to the fact that New Jersey is a very overlooked state when it comes to its natural history. The goal that we set for ourselves was to see 200 species in 24 hours. At that point, only 2 states in North America had managed to do that, and 1 Canadian province. So California, Texas, and Manitoba were the only places where 200 species of birds have been seen in 24 hours.
Wow.
And so I had David Tribble on the team and Roger Torrey Peterson. So the odds were stacked in our favor.
You had David Tribble. Yeah, I would say so.
And he's still kind of the co-author, or he is the illustrator for your book, correct?
Yeah, David Tribble.
Yes, yeah. David and I have collaborated on a number of books. Matter of fact, I gave him his first job when he left Cornell. So we've been friends ever since the 1970s.
Oh, I'm spending the winter here down in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I have my Sibley guide with me, which is helping immensely.
Home without it.
There you go. Exactly.
And as a matter of fact, I'm willing to bet you have multiple copies.
Well, I only have one, but it is of the Western birds. He wrote a book specifically of the Western birds. So that keeps me busy enough. So 200 species, is there a geographic area that the competition is limited to?
You have to stay within the state of New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
If your feet are in bounds and you see it in Pennsylvania, it counts. It's like catching a pass.
Okay.
But you can't be in Pennsylvania, even if that's the shortest route to where you want to go, and count the birds you're seeing in Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. Man, does this require visual observation, or does my Merlin app, you know, provide me assistance?
I'm not sure what the rules are now. Originally, it was by sight or sound, and I think 95% of the birds had to be tallied unanimously. So all members of the team had to agree that that's what it was, and then it could be recorded.
Oh, okay.
And so, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, Claire.
No, I was just, because I'm going to harken back to earlier discussions when you kind of had pointed out the different categories by which birds can survive the change in weather. And one of them was hibernation, and you had mentioned just one bird that was hibernating, but there's also something called torpor. Can you define that for us and how it differs from hibernation, but how birds utilize that?
You could call it semi-hibernation. So you throttle back on your energy use so that you can help get through the night.
So it's basically just almost just being restful.
Yes, that's it. I mean, hummingbirds do it, chickadees do it, downy woodpeckers do it.
So it is, though, just a couple different species that do it. It's not across the board. So you have the birds that stay active during the winter, the ones that do torpor, and then this one bird that hibernates. Is that kind of how it goes?
Yeah, that's a good summary. But, you know, birds have got other strategies, too. I mean, roosting is very important to survival.
And talk about that.
You can roost communally. Crows do. The proverbial, as the crow flies. Well, that's in the evening when they're going to roost and they're just taking a direct path. But other birds will roost together in a group. Nuthatches will roost communally in a tree cavity, where chickadees do not. Chickadees like to sleep alone.
I can honor that. That's good for them. In the last few minutes, again, what concerns you with respect to bird populations and the species? What birds are here, say, in the States are most threatened with extinction right now?
Well, I guess the grassland species are the ones that are declining faster than any of the others. But I'm just as concerned about the boreal species. The Canadian and Alaskan boreal forests are the planet's greatest hatchery. And if climate change affects, that forest, then there is going to be decline, because you run out of boreal forest when you hit tundra.
Right, and there's no new boreal forest being generated quick enough, let's say.
We've got 2 minutes, sorry.
Okay. So managing the winter is something they're adapted. How important are backyard bird feeders, let's say, or humans involved in feeding play a role in birds managing it through a typical winter?
Well, that is a game changer on the planet now. The proliferation of feeders means that birds have, in really bad conditions, have got a resource that they can rely on, which is why it's important to keep your feeders filled late in the day when birds are filling up, to go to sleep, and early in the morning when their energy reserves are depleted. So feeders, birds that go to feeders are not dependent on the feeders. It's a supplemental diet, but at times when it's important to them. When you've noticed chickadees coming to your feeder, and they land, they grab a sunflower seed, they fly off. Well, they're hiding that for later. And a chickadee will actually hide 100 seeds in 2 hours. And over the course of the fall, they might hide thousands of seeds. So you forget to fill your feeder one morning, it's not dire, because they're just going to go raid their stock.
That's really interesting, because I noticed that behavior, and I always thought that maybe they just grab one seed and they go off and they eat it and then they come back. If maybe it's for like security purposes, or it's safer to go off to a safe place, eat it, but they're storing it that way. That's really interesting.
And they sometimes store those seeds 2 miles from the place they found it.
What? Wow.
All right. Well, we got to wrap up. The name of the book again is The Courage of Birds and the Often Surprising Ways They Survive Winter. The author is Pete Dunn, and the illustrations again are done by David Sibley, the great bird illustrator. Pete, thank you so much for joining us. Do you have a website that people can go to learn more about your work?
I don't. I'm indentured to the printed word. And so I don't like to dilute that. So I've always got another book coming out. So if you want to keep track of what I'm doing, just go online, type in Pete Dunn, and up will come a bunch of books.
Perfect.
And by the way, it's Pete Dunn Birder. There is a Pete Dunn professional wrestler in the UK, and it's not me.
Okay. We'll keep that in mind. Thanks, Pete.
Thank you. Pete Dunn Birder. Thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
You are listening to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us now is award-winning author and professor David George Haskell, whose latest book, Sounds Wild and Broken, has received many accolades, including being a finalist for the 2023 Pulitzer Prize and the Editor's Choice for the New York Times Book Review. We're thrilled to introduce you all now to David George Haskell. David, thank you so much for talking with us today on This Green Earth.
Thank you, Claire. Thank you, Chris. It's a delight to join you.
Yes. Well, first off, please share more about your background and what brought you to write about such topics and the importance of sound in nature.
So my background is first of all, as a biologist. I had an undergrad degree. I was passionate about zoology and animals, all sorts of creepy things and flying things and so on. And then I continued that into grad school and then taught biology in college for 20 years. And I really wanted to share some of the amazing stories about the intricacy of ecological life, of evolution, some of the challenges that we're facing in terms of conservation and environment beyond the classroom. So that's why I picked up my pen and started writing. And I think sound is the great revealer, because sound works at night. It works in the deep ocean, in dense forests. It passes through closed doors. It reveals environmental injustice. And yet we don't often really give sound enough attention. I know here on the radio, people are into radio, have their ears tuned and open most of the time. But I do think if we bring that level of attention to the more than human world of whales and crickets and birds and things, but also to how we humans are interacting with them, there's some amazing, beautiful stories about belonging and adaptation, and also some quite disturbing stories about how we're degrading the sounds of the living earth.
And we do want to get into all of that. And I appreciated the introduction of your book that talked about the importance of listening and being open to what connects us with nature, and one of those things being sound. And so take us to the beginning of these origins and the starting of that animal song and what that looked like, or I should say sounded like, back when everything is just kind of beginning and this is how they're communicating with each other.
Yes, and this is one of the amazing things I discovered actually in researching this book, is that for hundreds of millions of years, ours was quite a silent planet in terms of communicative animal voices. When the first forests rose, there were no singing birds, there weren't even any singing insects. So there was the sound of wind and of rain and so on, but none of the sounds that we'd associate today with a forest. Same thing with the first reefs in the ocean. Even though they were filled with complex animals, there were no fish or crustaceans or whales making the varied songs that we'd hear today. So sonic communication, what we now call song or calls, actually evolved very late compared to all of the other ways that animals use to communicate with each other, visual and chemical communication. But once it got going, sound exploded and linked creatures into these generative, creative webs of interaction. As far as we can tell on land, the very first singing creatures were winged insects that looked a little bit like crickets, the group of insects that are now extinct. But it was about 275 million years ago, and we know this, nobody had sound recorders then, of course, but we know it from fossil record, because the wings of these little insects have got tiny little ridges on them, just like the ridges that modern crickets and katydids use to make their chirping sounds. So we can infer, hey, these extinct little crickets had these, they were making sounds too. And before that, though, there's no evidence of any sound-making device in the fossil record. In the oceans, it was probably spiny lobsters, maybe some ancient fish that were making some of the first communicative sounds. So given that complex animal life evolved 600 million years ago, 275 million years, that's kind of late. And the reason for that lateness is probably because making a sound is dangerous. To this day, the only animals that use song a lot are the ones that can get out of the way of predators or that are well defended. Think about amphibians. Frogs are very vocal. They've got powerful hind legs. They can get out of the way when a predator shows up. Salamanders are quite slow, and they're completely silent. They don't sing at all. Same thing with birds or large mammals. You know, they vocalize, they make all sorts of sound, but worms and jellyfish don't, because it would be revealing their location. So this cost of making sound, the cost of revealing yourself to hungry predators, probably kept a lid on sonic evolution. But then when flying insects evolved, not only could they get away from predators, but insect wings, if you think about the structure of an insect wing, it's a papery surface attached to a vibratory muscle. It's essentially a living loudspeaker. And so from the evolution of the first insect wings to the first insect songs, it actually didn't take that long for evolution to figure out, hey, we can do something else with these wings as well as fly.
So those were kind of the first to start to evolve from these crickets, these tiny creatures on land. Take us into the depths of the oceans, and you said that where did we first start to understand that there was a lot of sonic vibrations and sounds happening in our largest water bodies that were communicative?
Yes, and this is an interesting cultural bias, I guess, or you know, even a biological bias, is that as land creatures, we humans have ears that are great at hearing in air, at least within a certain frequency range. But even if we submerge our heads underwater, we're terrible at hearing because our ears are adapted to getting sound out of vibrating air, not out of vibrating water. So until very recently, people thought the oceans and lakes and streams were mostly silent. And it wasn't until the invention of hydrophones that scientists really started to understand, oh no, the oceans are actually full of song. And there are some ocean-going cultures, whale hunting cultures, indigenous groups who could hear whales and fish coming up through the hulls of their boats. So it wasn't just scientists who discovered this, but it was really just in the latter part of the 20th century that we got a lot of data and a lot of good sound recordings of creatures like the most famous, of course, are the whales and other marine mammals. And theirs is a really important story. But it's also key to remember that many, many fish advertise their breeding location and attract mates through making songs with their swim bladders and other and bones and other cool structures that they have. And little shrimp make incredibly loud sound. Snapping shrimp, for example, are so loud that during World War II, the U.S. Navy hid its submarines in the beds where there were lots of snapping shrimp hanging around so that enemy hydrophones couldn't detect them. That would hide the sounds of the submarines. So there are lots of creatures from tiny, weeny little shrimp up to enormous whales that are using water to make and transmit sounds. And sound in water travels much faster than in air, and it gets attenuated a lot less quickly too. So it's actually a wonderful medium. You make a little bit of sound and it will carry for many meters, even if you're a tiny little shrimp, or if you're a whale, potentially that sound can reach all the way across an ocean basin to another whale across, like literally the other side of the Atlantic from you. So that was the wonders of ocean sound before we came along with our oil drilling and our ships, that unfortunately also that sound also travels all around the world as well. So we've got a real problem with sound pollution in the oceans. But it's the reason it's a problem is that the oceans are full of extraordinary sound. Lakes and rivers and some streams as well actually have quite a few singing fish. It really depends on the water body. You know, in rushing mountain streams, there's so much background noise that the fish don't even bother trying to sing. In swampy backwaters, the fish are a lot more vocal because their sounds aren't going to get drowned out. So, you know, they're, every song is adapted to its home. And that's true below the waves as well as up in the air.
So it sounds like told myself I wasn't going to say that, but it sounds like the animals developed sound as a way of maybe a defense mechanism, sounding alarms to protect themselves or their community, let's say, maybe as a mating calls to draw a mate. But there are certain species that develop sounds of a way of mimicking their prey, let's say. They develop sound to draw them in, or their marine species or land or birds or so that you could sight that might do that.
Yes, no, it's interesting. So often the communication is something seems, quite honest and straightforward, advertising a territory or shouting an alarm. One example of a more deceptive, sneaky way of using sound are birds called drongos in Africa that mimic the alarm calls given by other species. And so let's say I'm another species of bird, a babbler or some other species, and I've got food in my beak. Well, along comes a drongo, it makes the alarm call of my species. I freak out, I drop my food, and I run away because I think I'm going to get eaten by a predator. And the drongo swoops down and catches my food. Now, the drongos are really sophisticated in this, in that they match the alarm call to the species that they're trying to fake out. And also, they know that, once fooled, creatures often learn and don't fall for it the second time. And so the drongos actually switch up and use slightly different alarm calls the next time they visit the same species. So that's a very sophisticated sort of method of deception. There are other forms of mimicry. I mean, a familiar one to many people in North America are the northern mockingbirds. And then in the tropics, there are also some other species of mockingbird that mimic the sounds of sometimes hundreds of other different birds, mostly birds, but sometimes things like car alarms and human sounds. Not so much to steal food, although sometimes they fake hawk calls to chase off other birds, but mostly to almost like a DJ showing off how many clips they can put together in their remix to show their cognitive prowess and the depth of their memory and their creativity. So it's more mimicry as a way of showing off rather than as a way of explicitly sort of deceiving another creature.
It's so interesting that evolution of sound. I was just at a talk about wolves and how when they howl, if a wolf is on a certain pitch, another wolf will go on a different pitch so that they sound like a bigger pack. So they're all if they're all on different pitches, it sounds like a bigger pack than if they're on one pitch. It won't resonate in that way. So I just think it's very interesting that evolution of sound. We've talked from kind of the origins of it into what we know it as today and how humans are becoming a part of it or taking it in. Sounds like smells sometimes will evoke memories in us. And if you hear something, it will take you, if you hear something in nature, it will evoke a type of memory. What are our relationships as humans to sounds in the wild, and then also getting into our detrimental roles and diminishing them?
Yes, I'm glad you raised the question of sounds evoking memories, because I really think that's such an important thing to realize, is that we humans, because we are a species that uses sound to communicate through language, we have really sophisticated hearing and very, very good sonic memory compared to even our close primate cousins like the chimpanzees, bonobos, or gorillas, who are super smart. They've got highly developed cultures, but they're not so much sonic cultures as ours. So their sonic memory is not as good as ours. And this is one of the things we can offer young people in our lives, is just by stopping and listening to the birds or the insects or the vibe of a particular city street and celebrating that and sharing it, we create these emotionally laden memories that then give people an internal compass through the years and the decades. And I had a very vivid experience of this. I'm in my 50s now, and I grew up actually in France, in Paris, in an apartment building. But I hadn't been back to Paris in decades, and I visited some family there and heard the song of a Eurasian blackbird singing in a courtyard, a very resonant, rich sound. And I was immediately taken back to being a 3 or 4 year old. And all those memories came back just through that one sound of the bird that had a lot of meaning for me as a little kid. Now, I wasn't a bird watcher or bird listener back then. I was just part of the world I was in. But just like the smells of our elementary school classroom or of our, you know, our grandfather or our auntie's cooking can really take us back to our youth, so too can sounds if the people around us help us form those memories. So I think one of the things we can do as a mode of joyful celebration is to go out and listen to the birds, listen to the sound of the wind in cottonwood trees. And just like we'd go to a human concert to enjoy these sounds, do that for creatures that are not human beings, but are important nonetheless. So sonic memory is, I really think of it as an internal compass that orients us to home, that teaches us as we grow older what is changing, what's beautiful and what's broken. And it can be a way of motivating us also to think about fixing some of those things that are broken. For example, when voices drop out of the soundscape of home because those species have lost or have become less common than they used to be, there's nothing like actually feeling that in your body and your senses to really drive home the message that, oh, I need to do something about this and join together with other people around this. So humans, I think of us as a very paradoxical species in that we have the most extraordinarily complex and beautiful sounds on the whole planet probably come from humans, our language and also our music. Think about instrumental music, violins, electric guitars, whatever your favorite instrument, extraordinary. And it connects us together in community. It unifies us in really wonderful ways. But on the other hand, we're also the species that is silencing a lot of the planet by destroying habitats, but also overwhelming the voices of other species with our noise in the oceans, with shipping and oil exploration, around cities and industrial areas, or along busy highways with traffic noise and industrial noise. So we're the great creators of beauty, but also the great destroyers. And the good thing, though, about sound is that the minute we stop making the noise, the problem is solved. Unlike mercury pollution or CO2 pollution, I mean, mercury just sticks around for forever, right? It's an element. CO2 will stick around in the atmosphere for decades, if not longer. Noise pollution, the minute you fix a noisy ship or quiet its engine down, the sound is gone and the whales are no longer being driven to distraction by the noise we create. So the issue of noise pollution, I think, is severe, but it's also one that can be solved. The question of silencing, say, clearing great swaths of habitat and causing extinction, that is a much more hard problem to solve. We need to stop the destruction because, of course, you know, once something is extinct, it's gone forever. And sound reveals these stories to us, not as abstractions, but as lived, felt, sensed experience. And for me, at least, and I think for a lot of people, sensory experience is how we ground our ethics and how we get motivated and how we share things with other people. And my background is as a scientist, and I think graphs and statistics and all that are great and they're beautiful and necessary, but they're insufficient to the task of elevating these stories of beauty and brokenness and also then grounding human ethics in the world as it is, not just in abstractions like statistics.
If you just join us, we're speaking with David Haskell when we're talking about his new book, Sounds Wild and Broken, Sonic Marvels, Evolution's Creativity, and the Crisis of Sensory Extinction. And that's, you've been alluding to that third part of that subtitle, The Crisis of Sensory Extinction. But are there animals, marine or otherwise, that call out in a way that we can't hear, either lower than our auditorial capacity to hear, or pitched so high that we can't hear? Give us some examples of that.
Absolutely. We live in a world where much of the communication that is happening is beyond our senses. That's true, especially in sound, but it's also true, of course, with chemical communication. You know, my cat, when I had dogs running around, they were aware of all sorts of things that I couldn't smell. And that's one of the beauties, I think, of science, is it opens our imagination to those other channels of communication. In the sonic world, the most famous example are bats finding their food and communicating with each other using ultrasound, very high frequency clicks. But even my cat can hear much, much higher frequencies than I can, probably because cats evolved to hear the high frequency rustling and squeaking of little rodents. So my hearing is, you know, because I'm getting older, my hearing is dropping off at the higher frequency range. But even at its best, human hearing goes up to about 20 kilohertz. Cats can hear up to 50 or 60 kilohertz. Bats up into the hundreds. So there's this entire ultrasonic range that we're not aware of, but you can record it with ultrasound. But also with infrasound, these are lower frequency sounds than we can hear. The pigeons that are sitting on the city square can hear lower frequency sounds than any human. What does that mean? It means they can hear the thunderstorm when it's still 100 miles away over the horizon before I can even detect it. I mean, obviously I can see it on my phone app, but before the marvels of smartphones, pigeons and some other birds were hearing low frequency sounds to help them orient in the landscape. They could also hear the crash of waves. You know, when waves beat on the shore, they produce a lot of low frequency sound that we can detect with specialized microphones, but we can't hear. Whereas some birds and maybe some other animals, and elephants, for example, are another group of creatures that communicate using infrasound, sending low frequency sounds down into the ground so they can communicate over long distances with other elephants. And in the oceans, fin whales communicate using sounds that are at the very lower end of what we can hear. So normally when you hear a sound recording of a fin whale online or in a movie, it's actually been sped up so that we can hear it. So they're sending very, very low frequency sounds, probably so that they can travel really long distances. Low frequency sounds do really well at moving over vast differences, whereas sounds that are much higher pitched get degraded and absorbed much more quickly, which is why, you know, if you're hearing a rock concert from a long way away, you hear the bass, but you don't hear the electric guitar solo. Same thing happens out in the woods with birdsong and in the oceans with whales. So yes, we live in a limited frequency range. And I mentioned, you know, I've lost some upper frequency hearing, which is very, I mean, all humans experience that as we age, some of us faster than others. And that teaches us about the fundamental trade-off of being a human being, is that we get to have really amazing senses, like a great sense of hearing or sight or smell. And of course, everyone has their own strengths and weaknesses. You know, we're not all the same. And that's why we need one another to lean on one another to hear or smell when others can't. But that trade-off is you can only have sophisticated senses at the cost of losing them as you age. So the only creatures that are sort of immortal on this planet are things like very simple jellyfish that can self-renew their bodies. And as far as we know, they can live forever. But they can only do that because they have very, very unsophisticated brains and sense organs and so on. Anytime you get things to be really complex, you have the problem of aging. And so, and to me, that experience reframes things. It's like, well, yeah, I'm losing certain capabilities as I age, but that's the cost you pay for being a human and for enjoying the richness of senses that we have. So even in something seemingly as mundane as losing a little bit of hearing as we age, we learn something about evolution through paying attention to that.
And we talk about the vast world and all these different sounds and these animals that are making these different sounds, but I've also heard you say that it's important for us to maybe just stop and listen and be quiet in our own backyards to understand what's actually happening around us. Can you explain the importance of that and then maybe give people maybe some even tips to what we should do and how we should connect better through sound in our own environment?
Yes, that has been, as a teacher, but also as a writer, I think that's one of the fundamental guiding ethos of a lot of my books, is to offer that invitation to people to pay attention to the extraordinary in the everyday. Traveling to wonderful places, of course, is great, but that's a privilege. And we all, not, you know, we can't all be tourists the whole time. And so realizing that we are surrounded by a world of wonders, if only we give that world our attention, is the invitation that I'm offering. And sound is particularly valuable in this. And so, for example, taking a practice of just spending a couple of minutes every day stepping out of the back door to check in with the soundscape. What's happening today and how does it make me feel? What birds am I hearing? What's the sound of this tree compared to a different species of tree? I wrote a whole book called The Songs of Trees about the various sounds that trees make and what we can learn from that. And it turns out trees are actually quite talkative, particularly in the wind and the snow and so on. And there are lots of fascinating tales to be told there. But the key that I found in my own life is taking a very simple practice of going to the same place again and again, with no agenda other than opening the senses. Like, I'm not seeking redemption, I'm not seeking enlightenment, I'm not even seeking wonder, I just want to be present for the world for these 2 minutes to give it my loving attention and see where that attention takes me. And often it does take us into wonders, it takes us into very mundane things. Sometimes it stimulates curiosity. And sometimes it reveals great injustice and problems that actually things that are useful for us to hear. Hearing is, I mentioned at the beginning, is the great revealer, because we're hearing what's coming through a closed door or what's just over the horizon. Hearing we can also do through our fingers. It's not just through our ears. If you put your hand up on a lamppost when a truck is driving past, you will feel the vibrations, feel the sound in the lamppost or the tree, even though you may not detect it with your ears at all. And in that experience, you are then understanding what soil microbes and earthworms and voles are experiencing, because they live in this subterranean world where sound is mostly coming through solid matter. So diversifying the practice of what hearing even is, I think, is really, really an enlightening and joyful thing to be doing, putting our fingers onto things, walking barefoot and listening with the soles of our feet. Obviously, better to do that in the summertime than in the middle of winter up in the mountains. But the key is return again and again with open senses and let go of judgment. Let go of expectation and just be present for the world as it is. And then I guess the last thing I would say about that is invite other people into that practice. You know, we have a well-developed cultural tradition of listening to music together or inviting people over to watch sports at our house or for political events. Do it for the return of the swallows or when the sparrows start breeding in the chimneys on the top of the apartment complex or whatever sonic or natural manifestation it is that really you think is fascinating. Throw a party and invite other people into that experience. They may think it's a little strange, but I promise you they will be delighted to join you over a few, you know, some drinks and some snacks to celebrate the return of frogs to the swamp behind the parking lot or so on. And I really think we live in an age of alienation in some ways, where we feel alienated from the living earth, and celebratory invitations to other people help us overcome some of that alienation.
I think that is such great advice, and I hope we all take it and have listened to what that you had to say today and really take that to heart. David George Haskell, who has just written Sounds Wild and Broken, it is available now. And where can people go to find out more about your writings, David?
So my website is dghaskell.com for David George Haskell. And I've got links to all my books there and to reviews and also essays that you can read free online. But indeed, my book is now out in paperback and available in electronic forms as well. So I hope people will enjoy dipping into some of the sonic tales that I've shared.
Well, we appreciate you so much for being a part of This Green Earth. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Claire. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to This Green Earth. If you like the show and you learned something new, make sure you leave a review, and we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars.
You can email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas for topics and stories you'd like us to cover to This Green Earth, all one word, at kpcw.org.